George Matthew is a managing director at Insight Partners, where he invested in Weights and Biases, Jasper, and others. He has over 20 years of experience developing high-growth technology startups, including most recently being CEO at Kespri. George joins the podcast to talk about his path to becoming an investor, his data-first thesis about investment, the AI business landscape, his book recommendations, and more. This episode of Software Engineering Daily is hosted by Jocelyn Bernhuhl. Check the show notes for more information on Jocelyn's work and where to find her.
George Matthew, welcome to Software Engineering Daily.
Great, Jocelyn. Great to meet you as well. Pleasure to be here.
We're really excited to spend some time talking with you personally, as well as for our show's audience, our technical audience. You know, there's nothing hotter to talk about than AI or data, I think. You have been a storied investor in this space, right? So many investments so early on in Weights and Bias, Excel Data, which is one of my favorites, Jasper. We're really excited to have you come and talk with us. But before we kind of get into the technologies that you're interested in, you know what? I want to learn a little bit about you. Were you just a young, like little boy out in the playground thinking like one day I'll be an investor in this space? Or like, how did you come to realize this is what you wanted to do?
Yeah, I would say it certainly wasn't a portion of my journey that I thought I was going to be an investor when I was a young kid in the playground. I think originally my intent when I was that young was probably to be a pilot. When I got a little bit more older, I realized that that wasn't going to be the right calling for me. And then I really wanted to be a medical doctor. And as I was studying actually for my MCATs my junior year, I came across the NCSA Mosaic browser, which a certain individual named Mark Andreessen had shipped out of the supercomputing facility at the University of Illinois. And I would say my heart skipped a beat back in 1996 and really wanted to understand what was going on with the emergence of a tool and technology like the World Wide Web and the modern day web browser in those days was pretty early in the overall journey. And I just got really excited by that and followed a lot of where my passion was there to go find a job in California to work in an early stage company that was doing the first generation of e-commerce applications in the mid 90s, working over emerging technologies around the World Wide Web.
You know, it's such an interesting moment that we're experiencing right now, because I do think, you know, my two big sea changes that I've experienced, right, was the internet came in and replaced client server. And then, of course, open source. These were like huge moments, right, that felt like second industrial revolutions. And they're paling in comparison to some of the excitement around generative AI at the moment. Help me understand a little bit about what is your perspective on investing in generative AI right now? Because there's a lot of interest on the consumer side, but it's not clear which startups and what their strategy should be.
A lot of my perspective from investing in generative AI has really come from being originally a builder and someone who's been in around data and AI systems for a good part of a decade and a half. And as I started to see this current generation of systems continue to evolve, it was just very clear in the enterprise that the modern data stack itself was just an important underpinning for how this next generation of AI-based applications and systems would emerge. And so I really started to look at where the modern data stack was really headed when it comes to all the tools that were required, not only in data management, but data catalogs, data orchestration, data observability, and really built my thesis on just a data-first view of how this next generation of AI and machine learning-based systems would emerge. And so naturally from that layer of the modern data stack, started to look at machine learning operations, MLOps, right, as a necessary set of tools that would be required for a machine learning practitioner to be able to build a model and be able to bring those models into production. And so one of my first investments joining Insight about 3 years ago was in a company called Weights and Biases, which became, of course, one of the de facto tools for all the experiment tracking, hyperparameter tuning, version controls that were necessary for a machine learning practitioner to be able to get their job done and effectively build models and bring them into production. I think as you started to see the evolution of MLOps, then it became clear that there was this opportunity to take the data that was coming from these modern data stacks and merge them properly with the AI systems, which are, of course, now LLMs and transformer-based AI systems, and build these next generation of generative AI applications. And of course, one of our investments about a year and a half ago was a company called Jasper, which was building a generative AI application for how content writing could be more naturally be done with a co-pilot to support how content writers work on a day in, day out basis. So the thesis for me was always starting with a data substrate, which at least in my case in the enterprise was very much targeted towards the modern data stack itself, and building upon itself to go into MLOps and more recently into generative AI applications.
There's a blog post on the website about the difference between MLOps and LLM ops. And, you know, I interviewed Krishna Gotti from Fiddler on this show as well. So I spent a lot of time in that ML ops space. Help me understand what the, well, maybe we should sort of say like what we say this ML ops or LLM ops, let's just set a business case. Like, why do people care about that? And then let's kind of compare and contrast the two.
So one of the things that we started to notice with emergence of this category of machine learning that was really focused on transformers and large language models was that you were shifting from a model-centric experience to getting a model into production and getting success out of the outcomes of model production to almost a data-centric world of getting models into production. And the reason I mention that is that the models weren't tremendously changing in terms of what was going into the algorithm of the models per se. You might see some shifts in the weights and biases surrounding a model, but less so around the underpinnings of the model itself. What was changing pretty dramatically was the data that was coming into the models. And this is where, you know, we started to see this current generation of transformers and LLMs in particular emerge, that the more data that you brought into a large language model, the more human-like and reasoning you started to see the models perform in terms of when they were put into, you know, a general purpose scenario like what you saw with OpenAI's ChatGPT, or even domain-specific models that emerged, say, for instance, like Bloomberg GPT. And in all these cases, what became clear was the techniques that you were using to go build a LLM was going to be similar, but in some ways quite different from the techniques that you would be using to build a model for the purposes of, you know, what would be a traditional use case around computer vision, for instance, or around a predictive statistical analysis that you might be doing. So we started to think about this at Insight. Where would be the delineation of where tools and platforms would evolve for the systems of record versus the systems of prediction versus the systems of creation? And so we've had a lot of history around the systems of record and the systems of analysis or prediction, but we haven't had a lot of history in terms of really understanding what these sort of new systems of creation were. And I think that's where we put a lot of our attention more recently in what's basically known as LLM ops versus ML ops. And in that regard, as we try to navigate, you know, what those differences were and those similarities were, there were some things that really struck us as clear delineations. First and foremost, if you look at a generative model and compare it to historically predictive-oriented applications, there was this tremendous benefit that came out of transfer learning. And the models themselves had this ability to, little bit of data, few-shot learning, single-shot learning, be able to transfer learn quite a bit from what was previously taught to the model itself. And so that was really different from what was historically the case with a predictive model that was in market prior, whether you were using a neural network or any other algorithmic method. In a similar way, you started to see a difference in terms of how the compute had to be managed, right? Because there was a tremendous amount of just compute required, particularly GPU-based compute, that was required to be able to not only do the heavy training that was required to build a model, right, with the number of parameters that we're now seeing in a model reaching as much as a trillion parameters in the GPT-4 style of model, but also in the inference itself. It was a compute-intensive experience to be able to handle the inference, even in a model like what you're seeing with OpenAI's GPT-4 or Anthropic or Cohere. And the last thing that we saw as a difference is just the feedback loops. If you think about the use of RLHF, a reinforcement learning through human feedback, or an RLAIF, in all of these situations, the feedback loops were more important than ever just to be able to improve models, particularly as they were in production. And you're starting to see this notion that the model is almost a living, you know, thing that continues to improve upon itself using reinforcement learning beyond the initial training runs themselves. And so those were sort of the key things that really pushed us to push out our perspective on what was really importantly delineated around building for LLM ops versus ML ops. And of course, there were many things that were, you know, similar in nature. Data privacy was very similar in terms of how you worked with ML ops versus LLM ops. Model governance, model security, which I'm sure you spent a bit of time with Krishna and Profiler, one of our portfolio companies in that regard. But in that regard, what we wanted to just really call out for anyone who was interested in this next generation of models as they emerged, the LLM models in particular, what would it take to build it and how is it different from this last generation of machine learning? And that's really what we try to encapsulate in that article.
Okay. And so in a couple of ways, just to summarize a little bit, what you're saying is like on the left-hand side of the diagram, it's a lot of the same problems of data preparation, data privacy, putting the, you know, data that from an enterprise perspective, you feel comfortable is ready to go in. But on the right-hand side, it's quite different because unlike ML that's telling you about the data you've already got, it's generating new data and there's a much more of a role for the human in the loop on that right-hand side of sort of iterating and using the model. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think it's fair. And I think there's some things that go into the compute management, which we've never had to really think about at the scale that we have to think about, particularly in both the model training as well as the model inference.
And we learned our lesson in cloud data, so we're going to think about it early now. Think about our expenses early. I will just share, put in the notes as well. You have a really amazing landscape of LLM ops. People are sending it to me all over, you know, all over the LinkedIn. And my friends are like, hey, have you seen this? So I think it's terrific. And I would definitely encourage the audience to take a quick look at it because I think it has this notion of end user management that I wanted to really double click on. I've heard you do some other interviews where you talk a little bit about how the ability to integrate human feedback is an asset in your mind. Is that what you mean when you talk about end user management as part of this?
Yes, it is okay. One of the pieces, right? For sure. The feedback loop is pretty important because if you start to think about how model alignment occurs, right? Building models that have values that are aligned with human beings, the only way to be able to do that is to have humans in the loop to be able to provide the feedback to models as they continue to be aligned for our needs. I think there's also another piece of the puzzle, which is when you think about the beyond the model itself and how you instill that into, say, for instance, an enterprise experience, you need more than just a powerful model with good feedback loops. You also happen to need to get good private data sets, right? It turns out that those private data sets are the ones that really enable models to further target and focus the task at hand and hallucinate less, right? So the more complementary private data that you have to the task at hand, the less likely it will hallucinate on things that were basically not having enough data that was being folded into the model in terms of the model training itself. The third thing I would also mention on top of that from a user experience standpoint is that you still need to think about this as an enterprise application. And so great enterprise applications have great UX and workflow associated with it. And if you're building an enterprise-grade application, it's not just about the human feedback loops in the models themselves, but it's a great user experience for the application front end. And it could be as simple as a chat interface. It could be a more complex workflow. But nevertheless, a great user experience surrounding that is absolutely essential for any AI-based application to prosper in the enterprise.
Have you tried Firebase or Supabase but wanted a better developer experience? Convex is a backend as a service product that's changing the way founders think about designing their infrastructure layer by letting anyone write their backend like they would write their frontend. Convex is designed for devs to write their backend in pure TypeScript, and it features a fast database written in Rust. Also, the self-managed version of the platform is now open source, and the team has been excited to share their thoughts behind the decision. Convex's CTO and co-founder, James Kelling, recently joined the Software Engineering Daily podcast to talk about the decision landscape for teams considering the shift to open source. Check out the conversation to hear all about it. Be sure to visit convex.dev to see why Convex is the best backend as a service for developers who want to ship quickly.
Yeah, I want to get back to that. But first, I want to talk a little bit about this like high-value private data, high-value data sets for train on to, you know, help give direction to the generative AI model, LLM model. You know, my experience has been that people who have the tastiest, most desirable private data are typically the ones who have like sort of the least capabilities often in building their own software, creating their own tools. You know, do you think that has implications? Because I agree, you have to have this like private, rich data. But do you think that has implications for like this whole debate around will it be proprietary open source models that win overall? It's hard to form an opinion there when you know that the organizations with the best data often are going to be reaching out to maybe a more proprietary organization rather than building their own with, say, a bundle of open source models. Have you given some thought to like what is that sort of adoption route going to look like?
Let me kind of call out a few things in terms of what we've seen up to this point at the sort of tail end of 2023, and then where things continue to or will continue to evolve in 2024. First and foremost, like anyone who's gotten a model into production right now, it does seem like it's pretty much OpenAI, right? And there's probably a few other things that are coming down the pike, including work that Anthropic and Cohere are doing, as well as a number of the open source providers, and particularly Llama 2 is a pretty exciting option when you look at the compactness of the model itself and just how it's commercially available to be licensed from an open source underpinning. I think for the folks who are building, and I mentioned that this need to have proprietary or private data sets, I don't know if it matters as much whether you're kind of working over time with an open source or a closed source model. I think it matters a lot in terms of what the model performance is, and it matters a lot in terms of what the likelihood that the model hallucinates as it is out of the box, how much you can either fine tune it or you can use a retrieval augmented generation surrounding the model and being in production so that you can sort of, you know, coax it to deliver the results that you want it to. But in almost all those cases, it's really going to be about model performance and feedback loops and whether it achieves the objective that you would want in terms of your model being in production. And right now, it does seem that the closed sourced, and particularly OpenAI as a closed source model today, is the highest performing model. And that's where, you know, most of the fine tuning is happening as we speak. I think over time, we're going to see some amount of diversity. It's not going to just be OpenAI closed source models only. When you think about the type of narrow AI use cases where, you know, you look at like trade settlement and clearing in a back office for a financial services organization, some really massive opportunities there in terms of being able to introduce a generative model to help complement the work that humans are doing in that regard. But when you look at what kind of model would you use, do you need to have a model that understands 14th century European history to be able to do trade settlement and clearance? Probably not, right? And so I think this is exactly where a smaller form factor model, whether it be open source or not, it seems like some of the more capable smaller form factor models are coming from the open source world. Those models could be just as relevant for tuning and training a very specific private data set to be able to accomplish a very specific task at hand from a narrow AI standpoint. So I think some of that's going to be coming to a theater near us in 2024. We just haven't seen it yet, mainly because it seems like most of the models in production, at least the generative AI transformer-based models that are in production today, are very much leaning towards a fine-tuned version of OpenAI.
That's really helpful perspective. You know, just covering the media, it seemed like that was a more mature discussion. But I think what I'm hearing is we're still at early days there in terms of which direction most enterprises are going to go for their enterprise adoption of LLMs.
Yeah, I mean, if we kind of cast this at the end of the first inning I would agree that there's quite a bit more of the game to be played out. And I think we're going to see more variety and diversity in models as they're in production. It just so happens, you know, at the first inning of the ball game, at the end of it, there seems to be only one that, you know, has at least reached production level value for most enterprises.
This episode of Software Engineering Daily is brought to you by Vantage. Do you know what your cloud bill will be for this month? For many companies, cloud costs are the number two line item in their budget and the number one fastest growing category of spend. Vantage helps you get a handle on your cloud bills with self-serve reports and dashboards built for engineers, finance, and operations teams. With Vantage, you can put costs in the hands of the service owners and managers who generate them, giving them budgets, alerts, anomaly detection, and granular visibility into every dollar. With native billing integrations with dozens of cloud services, including AWS, Azure, GCP, Datadog, Snowflake, and Kubernetes, Vantage is the one FinOps platform to monitor and reduce all your cloud bills. To get started, head to vantage.sh, connect your accounts, and get a free savings estimate as part of a 14-day free trial.
Just from a product design perspective, if you're designing a product today and you want to incorporate an element of LLM, do you think there's going to be like impacts on the way that we actually even do product design?
I think so. As a former product manager myself and someone who's led product management teams prior to becoming an investor, I think for product leaders, you have a few things that you have to kind of think about. One is, when you design software, historically, most software has had an underpinning of a rules engine associated with it. Like, you know, these are the sequences of things that we encapsulate in our software. And as long as it does those things, it comes to a deterministic outcome. And here we are, you know, we have a beautiful piece of potentially workflow-based software that, you know, follows those rules.
That's how it works every time.
Seems to have worked in software for, you know, 40 plus years. Now, I think what we are on the precipice of is systems that are less about these deterministic outcomes and more about having a probabilistic set of reasoning associated with it, like human-like smarts and reasoning associated with it that is embedded into the software itself. So imagine the rules engines of yesteryear now being replaced by a generative model as the underpinning, a model that continues to improve upon itself, a model that learns, a model that has reinforcement learning surrounding it. And so if you're a product manager thinking about the new products and services you're coming to the market with, you have to almost now introduce this mindset of what a probabilistic reasoning system could look like in software, either alongside of your rules engine or, you know, kind of completely reimagining your rules engine, one or the other. And so, you know, people in a funny way sometimes ask me, well, what's the scale and impact of AI in the market? Well, at the very least, it's going to be the total addressable market of all of software, and the could be, you know, the total addressable market of all of humanity. But at the very least, on the software end of the spectrum, you have this really interesting moment as a product leader to be able to take everything that you have historically known in terms of building rules-based software and replacing it with a probabilistic model that has human-like reasoning associated with it. And I think there's some powerful things that are coming about, particularly in enterprise software, if you take that first principle mindset to how you're designing the software of the future.
Yeah, I agree with that, right? It's a different mindset, different set of tools. And I also think subject matter experts are going to be invited back into the design sessions more. We kind of over-indexed on like, let's ask the users. But, you know, kind of back to what you were saying about Mosaic coming out, when the internet happened, you know, apps kind of were the pointy end of the spear. And to build those apps, you need those subject matter experts who deeply understood what are the expected outcomes, what is that workflow. And similarly, I think for product design, there's going to be a requirement, right, to have these Sherpas help guide everyone through, you know, complex, very specific enterprise use cases.
Subject matter experts, process experts, folks that who understand how the back end workflows between humans and machines have historically worked. Those are all opportunities to reimagine it with generative AI-based software as its underpinning.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I think that's kind of exciting in a way because a lot of that's still broken.
As a listener of Software Engineering Daily, you understand the impact of generative AI. On the podcast, we've covered many exciting aspects of Gen AI technologies, as well as the new vulnerabilities and risks they bring. HackerOne's AI Red Teaming addresses the novel challenges of AI safety and security for businesses launching new AI deployments. Their approach involves stress testing AI models and deployments to make sure they can't be tricked into providing information beyond their intended use, and that security flaws can't be exploited to access confidential data or systems. Within the HackerOne community, over 750 active hackers specialize in prompt hacking and other AI security and safety testing. In a single recent engagement, a team of 18 HackerOne hackers quickly identified 26 valid findings within the initial 24 hours and accumulated over 100 valid findings in the two-week engagement. HackerOne offers strategic flexibility, rapid deployment, and a hybrid talent strategy. Learn more at hackerone.com/AI. That's HackerOne.com/AI.
One thing I learned as I was looking at the ML ops space, I'm going to ask you some other questions, but in the ML ops space, one thing I thought was a funny quote is like, no model runs the same way twice, which is sort of the same thing that's happening in LLMs, right? There's a proliferation of training cycles in the ML world. In the generative AI LLM world, there's like a proliferation of models, right? Let's say you've got your like controls around your data. Great. Like a proliferation of models, you've got bundles of models running, not just one. How are organizations going to adopt that in a safe way? Is there going to be like a feature registry type situation? Is it going to be an after-the-fact audit? What do you think is going to happen there?
I think there's a few things that are happening today, and there's a few things that will emerge, particularly with some of the regulatory frameworks that are also coming about. A few things that are happening today is just, as you called out, multiple models running in tandem with each other. It really calls for more orchestration capabilities, right? And I think that's a big need in the market. And you're seeing existing orchestration providers like Airflow now starting to jump in. And so we were the investors in a company called Astronomer, which is one of the leading purveyors of Airflow. So they're now entering into the space, as well as you have startups that are capable of delivering value from a model orchestration standpoint. And some great examples there include both Llama Index as well as LangChain. And so in all of those cases, it's the orchestration that's happening across the models and the data fabric that's underlying these models coming into production that's driving the need for orchestration tools. In a similar way, you're seeing the observability market continue to evolve and grow quite significantly. Again, you had Krishna on the podcast already. If you look at Fiddler's business, if you look at some of the other companies in that category of model observability, their focus is really to be able to do the necessary model observability that lets you understand the model performance, understands model performance from an overall monitoring standpoint, and then introduces things like traceability and bias detection and fairness into how the model monitoring is occurring. And so that's a very, call it, internal view of how models are either observed properly or orchestrated as two great examples. But there's also this external factor that's coming to theater near us very quickly, which is the regulations themselves. And what I'm going to like kind of see, you know, my kind of prediction going into 2024 is that there is a cast of regulations that are coming on a per industry basis where regulators are going to have updates in terms of what they're expecting models to do. And that's going to have to be managed from a software standpoint, from a governance risk compliance perspective, a GRC software standpoint. And so that's something that we haven't seen yet, particularly in the world of AI. But I think that's actually something to be really kind of paying attention to going into 2024, particularly the executive order and additional other layers of regulatory frameworks coming into the fold.
Yeah, I work with financials who are already pretty highly regulated. And this new wave of regulation is not only impressive, where you see like GDPR, the EU suggesting expanding, you know, you can elect not to be part of a AI-driven decision. right? as part of, as your customer experience. Like as a citizen, I think that's great. As a technical person, it makes me like a little sick inside because how do you do it?
Yeah, it's exactly. Like a question of how do you do it? It's like, okay, we know how to put humans and machines together and build systems and processes in the financial services world effectively. But now if you're being asked after you've done that and after you've done it well, how do you take the machine out of the loop and only have a human-based process? Tough.
Right. We're kind of at the very beginning of that. We don't know who's the regulator going to be. There's competing sets of proposed regulation. You know, one thing I do advise companies we work with is to get started with what you know. There's some no regrets work that should get started now because waiting for regulators is a losing business, right? That can be tough. So yeah, we talked about regulatory risk. We talked a little bit about data risk, right? And the need to orchestrate data, make sure you have a private, reliable data source if you're doing an enterprise use case. What about, we'll just briefly touch on these just because if you have an expertise in this area, but there's the other two kind of concerns that slow down adoption in companies are bias, right? Just model bias. And then some concerns around like just bad actors, prompt injection, that type of thing. What are you hearing and what are you telling people about those two areas of risk?
Yeah, by the way, I want to hit that in a second, but I do want to just elaborate on the data question a little bit more, and then we'll go into both those situations and detail those out. But on the data side of the world, and particularly privacy preservation around data and how do you handle it, I think there's two really compelling things that I've seen so far. One is where you're using synthetic data to generate like copies that are statistically significant for the value of a training run, for instance, or being able to just handle a privacy preserved version of the data, particularly as you're doing testing before a model goes into production or an application goes into production. So there's companies like Tonic that are doing a tremendous job in terms of just handling synthetic data generation. In a similar way, what we're starting to see is this notion of like, where do you keep all of your private data properly stored and managed? And so there's this idea of a privacy vault, right? And this is where Skyflow was probably one of the more unique players right now in this space, really focused on just a privacy preservation mode or on keeping all the PII data in one place in a secure API that has a one way in and out sort of door to get through. To get your information that's privacy preserving and everything else is kind of sort of left in the sort of hands of the application developer. But the privacy aspect of what you need to handle from a PII compliance standpoint is delivered by a service like Skyflow. So sort of knowing that is in place, then let's kind of talk a little bit about
I want to hear what you have to say about that, but I cannot overstate what a huge sea change it has been. The embrace of synthetic data, the embrace of things like Privacy Vault in organizations. I mean, it is a major step forward for organizations that were pretty immature on that. So I'm a big Tonic fan as well. So we'll do another show on synthetics another day.
That's great. But I think it actually leads nicely to the question that you were originally asking, which is, okay, how do you really think about just the security concerns and what are some of the underlying risks? I think one of the biggest things that, you know, we continue to see in this space is that this is not only an opportunity for great things to happen, good things to happen, but also a veritable treasure chest for nefarious actors to do unethical things. And I think some of that is just in the fact that you have these models that are capable of doing many things and they can be applied in very unethical ways. Some of it's just, you're just less careful with the security and the system surrounding how you're building and bringing things into production. I think when it comes to the point of around cybersecurity that I have been paying a lot more attention to more recently is the availability of unethical models. So an example of this is like WormGPT. Turns out that a number of black hat hackers that had some very capable skills in terms of hacking put that all into a generative model that they unethically trained and released that into the wild so that any level one black hat hacker could have the skill sets that were now available to someone who is way beyond that capability and skill, all encapsulated in a copilot that does, you know, the work that a level five, level six black hat hacker could do with the tools built into
democratizing bad actors.
Yeah, democratize into a tool that's generally available on the dark web for anyone to take advantage of that wants to use it for nefarious purposes. So I think that's one example of where the things that we are really excited by in terms of all this opportunity that's emerging with the scale of human productivity that's coming out of the emergence of generative AI there will be these dark corners, and these dark corners are going to come to a theater near us, and they're going to be pretty pronounced, and there's going to be some really public incidences that'll come about in 2024 and beyond that we just have to be much more aware of and much more guarded about than ever before, because the use of this is now, you know, possible for not only some of the black hat techniques that I just mentioned, but also just impersonation, right?
Right.
You can take 3 seconds of this conversation that we're having and synthetically generate, you know, my voice or your voice, Jocelyn, and now put that into an interactive voice response system and break through the typical IVRs that have been in place to secure someone's input into an online or voice-based account update for a bank. And so this is actually a lot trickier than all the rainbows and unicorns from all the opportunities that are coming. There's some really dark corners that we're still about to face as a society.
Yeah, we're in this awkward liminal space between incredible excitement about the opportunities and capabilities, but also we don't have enough tools or thought work yet to mitigate some of these risks.
Yeah, I mean, the scale of deep fakes right now that are coming to a theater near us is just unprecedented. And that should be troublesome for anyone who's thinking about this stuff today.
I think I read that's one of the things that inspired Joe Biden to do this executive order, is that he saw a fake of himself. Did you see that? In the news?
That, you know, it actually makes sense, right? It's like up to that point, we're like, you know, we'll get around to, you know, an executive order for AI. And then finally the president sees a deep fake of himself. It's like, oh, we should probably do something about this. I did not know that. That's amazing. Yeah.
That's like such a great feeling. Cause like sometimes people are like, oh, you sent that email. I'm like, I did. Like I already did. There's a million things you say and do that you don't remember. So it could easily be fake. So let's switch gears a little bit, because I wanted to talk a little bit about advising a lot of our audience are like technical entrepreneurs, people who want to quit their day job and, you know, start a company. Maybe they're already in like a small startup. They're in that seed or, you know, A round space. People have asked me, what do you do if you're an established company? You got started as a startup, but maybe you don't have generative AI in your pitch. Maybe you don't have it in your product. What do you do? What do you do to keep your investors engaged, to keep customers engaged? Because it's almost required to talk about it now. I'm sure you've gotten a similar question. What are your thoughts?
Well, we've been a little more proactive at Insight about this because we generally do believe that this is not just happy talk, and there's, you know, some genuine benefits of like reimagining your software business as a generative AI-based underpinned software business. And so in that regard, our Insight Onsite team, which is really helping our portfolio companies continue to grow and scale in their specific journeys, whether it be in sales and marketing or talent or product and engineering or finance or business development. In all of those functions, you can kind of see two big opportunities emerge for generative AI. One is just better products and services, and then more efficiently running your business. And so in that regard, in the last 6 months, we've spent time with all of our portfolio companies to help them think through exactly those two levers. You know, what are the products and services that you can be building with what you have today that will enable you to continue to expand into the opportunities that you have in market because of generative AI, as well as helping you run your businesses better, mostly sales and marketing, it turns out. And now it is, in our view, a situation where I would be actually delighted to be a company that's already in market that doesn't necessarily have a generative AI strategy. Why? It turns out that you have incumbency. It turns out you have private data sets. It turns out you have a market where there is distribution because you are the incumbent in the space. And in all of those moments where incumbency, distribution, and data pre-exist, it's actually not that hard to build a generative model, right?
Right.
You don't
Good
need
point.
Tremendous amounts of data science resources and machine learning resources because you're mostly requiring data engineering and great software developers, data engineering to get the data prepped in a way that you can tokenize and sort of train a model appropriately or tune a model appropriately. And then, of course, the development resources to be able to put that into an application in the right context. And so what we're seeing is a lot of existing folks who have had very little capability and expertise from an AI standpoint now start to build some incredible products and services. And if nothing else, look at how the incumbents in the space have been so capable of building great products. I mean, look at what Microsoft has done with GitHub Copilot as a, you know, starting point. Look at what Adobe has done with Adobe Firefly as a complement to being able to create a product that enables you to verify the sources of the creation of generative content and plug that into Photoshop. And so in all of these examples, what we're seeing is incumbents are actually not at a disadvantage. In fact, they might be at a relative advantage. Even if you are starting your AI journey very late, you can almost sort of catch up quickly by adopting some of the generative AI capabilities.
I love that. I'm an optimist at heart, and you're absolutely right. You've got the data, you've got the know-how, maybe you have the customer relationships. Those are the hardest parts. If you're already established, you've got some of that in hand. Let's say we're, because you mentioned Microsoft, you know, when you talk to entrepreneurs who are putting together their ideas, they're very early stage. There's a couple of items of common wisdom, which I'll share with you, and you can debunk it or agree. The biggest players, Google, Microsoft, Meta, are going to just sort of mop up here. They've already got so much money. They've got so much tailwind. You know, maybe you have to have a different idea process. What do you think about that?
Well, the one incumbent, which just literally emerged out of nowhere this past year that no one would ever have thought of as an incumbent, but now they are, you know, within a year, inclusive of the one incumbents you mentioned, is also OpenAI, right? And if you notice Developer Day, you know, not more than a week ago, a week and a half ago, what you saw was just a number of startups and startup ideas being completely eviscerated.
Just digested.
By just the capabilities that were introduced around GPTs and capabilities that were introduced around just context windows and all the additional features that, you know, OpenAI themselves announced.
That's right. For our audience, if you haven't Googled, just go into YouTube and just Google, like, did OpenAI just kill all the startups? There's some really good rundowns on that. I don't believe that to be true, but it was a huge set of announcements.
Yeah. And again, can OpenAI do all those things that kill all those startups? Probably not, because there's so much surface area to cover. It's impossible for one company to do all that. And that's why a great startup ecosystem continues to thrive, particularly in the generative AI space. I think what you're going to have to think about as a founder, though, is you can't be working towards a feature that can be disrupted quickly. You have to be working towards, at the very least, a strong, unique product that maintains its value proposition, if not, you know, a broader platform that certainly has resistance and resilience in an overall market. I think that's harder to do. It takes longer. It takes more investment to build products and platforms over time versus features. I think the features are going to get really sort of folded into the incumbents that are building already in the markets that they're in. But I think there's ways that you can build, you know, great products and platforms. I mean, just look what Jasper has done. You know, they started as a prosumer offering in content creation for content marketers around generative AI. And it turns out, you know, OpenAI came in and really sort of ate into that original core assumption in the prosumer market. But that enabled Jasper to take all everything that they learned and go into the enterprise and build great workflows and great applications and great embedded experiences for how enterprise marketers work today. And I think that's a lesson to be taken for all founders going through this journey, that even when you feel like you have, call it product market fit, and you have success, you will have to make some changes so that you can find long-term durability. My view is that as a founder right now, you can't build for features and you can't be thinking just about the product alone. You have to be thinking both about product and go-to-market simultaneously. And it's interesting because if you talk to any second-time founder, that's really how their mindset is. It's, you know, first-time founders always have the sensibility that it's about product. And yes, it is, of course, starting with product. But second-time founders are like, yes, it's about product, but then how do I go bring it to market?
So it's like, George, what does that mean? I hear people talk about GTM all the time, but I would assume what you're saying is like, hey, I've got the next great widget. This is a cool product. Is go-to-market like, hey, I have a letter of intent from a big customer and we're going to co-design this? Like, what are those, practically speaking? What would those
be? I mean, in the early days, it's good design partners. It's good focus for folks who are going to co-collaborate in building what you're bringing to market. But I think soon after that, like when you're closer to the first iteration, your MVP, call it, your first iteration of the product, then you got to quickly move your mind towards commercialization and how do you get paid for what you're building. And I think in previous incarnations, we've had more time and we've had more ability to keep building and not have to worry as much about commercial value and selling and, you know, being good at finding the things that you're building have some ability to
It's just being like ruthlessly focused on what's going to sell, not just what's like, you know, close to your heart.
Yeah. And focus earlier on that than you want. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that in this cycle of iteration and how, at the clock speeds that we're moving at right now, you're going to have to really find your commercial value faster. And even after you find your commercial value, you might have moments where you still have to pivot.
Yeah. It's moving so fast. The penalty is success. High. Right. It's so easy to say and hard to do. Like when you're in the situation as a product, so you fall in love with your product. You've got, you know, certain things. And, you know, even though it's a simple statement, I actually can't underline this enough for our listeners, how important that is, that kind of ruthless focus on what people are going to buy.
I mean, for great founders as product people are tortured artists. I get it. Like, I was certainly one of those folks myself. But I think the best founders in time not only are the tortured artists, but are the world-class salespeople. And so if you can take the combination of tortured artist and world-class salesperson and bring that together, those are the founders that will go the distance over time.
Well, speaking of founders that go the distance, right? We talked a little bit about the overall market, some things you're looking at in 2024, some like signal. You've got your own point of view as an investor. You know, you've invested in some, you've got your current portfolio companies. Do you want to share some stories of how some of your current portfolio companies have checked off the boxes you think are important in developing in this area?
Yeah. I mean, I'll give two examples of companies that have some tremendous scale. I mentioned Weights and Biases, but I think it's important to understand that when we had a great blog post about Lucas and his journey around Weights and Biases more recently, the reason why Weights and Biases has worked so well in the market is that Lucas had his first startup, which was Crowdflower, and he had all of the challenges of building Crowdflower in his mind as a second time founder that went to market and not only built a phenomenal product, but figure out a way that it commercializes and scales. Insight was lucky enough to catch Weights and Biases even before the commercialization really started. And now we're starting to, 3 years later, we're starting to see the tremendous scale of how big a business like Weights and Biases, particularly as a leading tool in the MLOps, LLM ops world, can get. I think outside of even just the AI space, where software businesses are becoming AI businesses, what Christine Yen is doing with Honeycomb is fascinating, right? Because it's not just the fact that you're building a next generation observability product that is fully differentiated from all the existing incumbents in the space, but they're doing innovative things like introducing generative capabilities into a traditional system observability market. And it turns out that in the case of Honeycomb, what the unique value proposition of introducing generative AI was that every observability product has somewhat of an esoteric language to be able to work in the context of, you know, finding that observable event. If you introduce natural language as the front end, you know, how much easier and how much more democratized could an observability product be? It's exactly the thesis that the team went in at Honeycomb to go build a natural language interface using a fine-tuned OpenAI experience into a query builder for Honeycomb. It was the fastest adopted feature in Honeycomb's history, where 40% of all of Honeycomb users were on that product within the first 24 hours of it launching, to give you an idea of how fast the adoption curve occurs. So what I would generally give advice to founders as they're going through this is really continue to find those great moments of product differentiation early as well as later in your product development cycle, and then be willing to continue to experiment and iterate in the first commercialization successes that you have. Don't rest on those laurels. Like, find different ways that you can continue to commercialize and scale your business, because the market continues to evolve very quickly and you want to be resilient for all those changes that are occurring.
Very interesting. We're kind of wrap up here at the end of our discussion, and I really appreciate you taking the time. You know, just one kind of last idea here. You have a point of view as an investor. In the last few years, You know, a lot of investors have different ways of approaching the market. Some of them don't have a point of view. Some of them kind of like, I'll take your point of view and I'll use that too. You know, what do you think they're doing well in this space and what could they be doing better?
So I think most VCs are just very good at sensing when there's a shift in the market and really embracing that shift. And so if you think about where momentum is occurring, VCs have some of the best sense of momentum that could be. And that, you know, now, no surprise, kind of has played out in how the generative AI market has really evolved, because, you know, VCs have put a lot of energy, a lot of investment directly into that market. Now, I think where we as VCs can do a lot better over time is just really truly understand how hard the founder journeys are, right? And be more empathetic to how difficult these journeys are. Because as much as, you know, you're like, hey, you should move into this portion of the market, and you should do, like, that takes work. That takes a lot of
just
energy.
Do that.
That takes a lot of lot of calories. And I think the best VCs at some point have figured out a way to have that empathy in terms of really understanding what the founder's journey is and being able to, you know, be a co-pilot to their journeys. And I think for me personally, that empathy came from just having to have been one as a founder and a builder in the past. And that kind of gave me a little bit of that empathy as I went into venture capital. And, you know, for the venture capitalists that haven't necessarily done that, that's okay, because I think you have enough experiences of just being on boards, being with founders, that you should be able to translate that to providing proper empathy for them. And I think in most cases, the more that we are empathetic as VCs and the more that we understand the momentum that's occurring in the market, the two of those things combined together, generally, you know, you're going to end up with a reasonable set of investments made as
you're, I love that.
You know, kind of progressing.
I love the idea too, that you don't have to have been a founder, but they just be with them. I like that phrase. That simple phrase is great. Just be with them for a while, sit with them, you know, and experience their point of view. I love that. All right. Last question. My inbox and every bookshelf is just topped up with information in this space and reading material that I often don't get through. You know, for our listeners, what are one or two things that you've read, or newsletters, or, you know, articles that, you know, obviously Insight has some great ones, but, you know, if there were one or two things that somebody wanted to read, what would you recommend right now?
Yeah. I mean, as far as like a lot of the thinking on responsible AI, certainly, you know, the work that we've seen in market by observability leaders like Fiddler has been great. I would also add the constitutional AI frameworks that are emerging. Anthropic is probably one of the folks that have been leading that work, and some of the work that's surrounding constitutional AI and RLAIF, the use of reinforcement learning and AI systems to almost guardrail how AI is in the wild, is a very emerging and topical field. And I would sort of dig into that. I think kind of more broadly, if you think about responsible AI and where it's going to play out in the next few years, like, we just have to build better aligned systems to human values. And I think one of the original thoughts on that was just what Brian Christensen had wrote around a book called The Alignment Problem. So I would highly recommend taking a look at that book as a way of really thinking about, you know, how we can build better aligned systems. And, you know, if you want to just have a discourse on just how we think about AI systems and the future of AI systems sitting alongside of humanity, one of my favorite recent works on this topic was a series of essays that were compiled into a book written by Megan O'Gibley called God, Human, Animal, Machine. And it was a wonderful sort of amalgamation of her thoughts on what it took to build this current generation of AI systems and what are the types of people that really are finding meaning around the AI systems that could be part of what I almost think of as co-pilots to our lives. And so those are probably three books and three sort of sources that I'd be inspired by.
I almost didn't ask that question. And now I learned at least two new things from you. So thank you.
Perfect.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. Software Engineering Daily, thanks to you. I know our audience is super excited to hear from you. Hope you have a great rest of your day. Thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you again. Appreciate it.